coming up on Life as a Festival.
So there's this whole kind of informal organization which has emerged that's simply handling the humanitarian affairs of this mass movement. That's something that I've never seen before. There's also people, it really does seem like a festival. There's like a group of Scottish Shioban Trust that has prayer flags on their tent, and they have a wood-fired pizza oven and are walking around with the big, you know, wooden spatulas handing out pizza to people. And there's all these pop-up tents and food trucks that kind of has this, you know, almost like an Austin hipster, you know, food truck park thing going on. And many people, when they arrive here, say it looks like a festival. And I think there's a lot of good that comes from welcoming people with joy and having this kind of environment that's much different than usually the sterile, very process-oriented NGO response.
My name is Eamon Armstrong, and this is Life is a Festival. This podcast is a celebration of thinkers and leaders who live their lives with the open-hearted, experimental joy of a festival. Each week, we converse in complete openness, in an ongoing quest to find those boundaries in our being and melt them into lofty horizons. Life is a festival, only to the wise. Hello, my friends. Welcome back to Life is a Festival. I'm your host, Eamon Armstrong. So the very DNA of this show is how to bring the peak experiences, the joy, the optimism, the hope we feel at festivals into our daily lives. Where is that hope, optimism, dignity, creativity, and joy most needed in the entire world? Situations of displaced people. I'm talking about refugees. And in this case, on the program, we'll be talking about refugees leaving Ukraine and entering Poland and Europe. My guest today is Mike Zuckerman, a friend for many years and someone who I deeply, deeply admire. For the past 6 years, he has been focused on the global human migration crisis, and he has used principles from nightlife and Burning Man to create environments of more connectivity, art, and joy in these spaces. We begin our show with an overview of the Ukrainian refugee crisis and Mike's role on the Polish border. Then we get into Mike's personal history, how he started in nightlife, how he ended up in Uganda during the World Cup, and essentially how he began to craft a toolkit for approaching refugee environments in different ways. We talk about Burning Man principles and Mike's idea of a Leave a Trace festival for refugees. We talk about Uhuru Land, a unique artistic space in the oldest refugee camp in Africa. Then we get into discussion of what's going on the Polish border. We talk about how informal volunteers are making this border crossing feel like a festival. We talk about self-care in the context of disaster work. And finally, we get into how we can help. So you listening at home, how you can get involved. So Mike Zuckerman is obviously a bit of a legend in the Burning Man space, considering his extraordinary work with refugees. Mike has created and designed everything from environmental nightclubs to a global network of free spaces. And he has worked over the past 6 years on the global human migration crisis. He was a project manager for Elpida House in 2016, where he led a team of volunteers, refugees, and local Greek contractors to build a prototype camp, which was widely recognized as the most dignified living conditions for refugees in all of Greece. He has worked in Uganda, the Mexico-US border, Bangladesh, and he's currently on assignment with ALIGHT, formerly the American Refugee Committee, at the Polish border welcoming Ukrainian refugees. So my friends, refugee camps are the cities of the future. Why not bring the best of ourselves and the best of the joyful festival culture into these environments? Here is Mike Zuckerman. Mike, welcome to Life is a Festival. It's an honor to have you here. I'm so inspired by the work you do in the world. And I think there are some really profound parallels between the autonomous zones of celebration that you and I have both frequented and what can be created for displaced populations. And so I know that's been a huge part of your work, and I'm so thrilled to offer it to our audience today. Thanks for coming on the show.
It's great to be on your digital festival.
So just to get started, just to kind of lay sort of a foundation here, I want to, as we're discussing these displaced people, in this case, we'll be talking a lot about people leaving Ukraine and crossing the Polish border, which is where you've been for the past few weeks. Do we refer to these individuals as refugees? Is that designation important in how we speak about them? How should we be talking about these displaced people as we discuss this issue today?
Currently, we are referring to the Ukrainians and the third country nationals, the non-Ukrainians, as refugees. This is people fleeing a conflict. They're crossing a national state line, and they are referred to as refugees. There is distinctions between migrants and refugees and what their legal rights are, but there's very few people who have left Ukrainians who are applying for asylum because they already before this war had the ability to come into the EU for 3 months without a visa. So almost all Ukrainians coming into the EU are just here on regular visas and are going to wait this out and see what happens. And they may even extend that to be a 6-month process. But what's interesting to note is that non-Ukrainians who were in Ukraine, students, illegal immigrants, migratory workers, they are illegal in the EU, in the Schengen trade zone, after 15 days. So there's a whole different designation that non-Ukrainians are getting, and that presents a problem.
So when we think about refugees, they're often the purview of the UNHCR. Is the UNHCR administering this border crossing area where you've been working, or who is out there supporting these displaced people?
Well, UNHCR is not present at the border because they were not invited by Poland. This is kind of like, America has a crisis at our border often, but we don't allow the UN to come in that has their own jurisdiction and their own rules in our sovereign country. We prefer to handle it with US border control and protection. And Poland is doing the exact same thing. They're saying, like, we got this. And they're running their own border control and registering everyone who comes in. But UNHCR is not present, which is unique in a mass migration situation that I've experienced. And a lot of the coordination and just moving people through the border and through into Europe is happening simply by individuals and volunteers who have just shown up. A lot of Polish people were the first ones here because they live here and there was a great need. And then you've also have people who, through their own GoFundMe campaigns and loaded up their vans with supplies and set up a table and just are, supporting the line. And, that's unprecedented. This is a massive undertaking. It's the largest numbers in the quickest time that we've seen anywhere in the world since World War II. And I left at the end of February, so I've been here for over 3 weeks now, and the larger organizations are just starting to show up because they're required to get paperwork and approval from the local government, from the state government, from the border crossing and control. So it's taken them weeks, and in the meantime, hundreds of thousands, maybe even over 700,000 people have passed at the Medeka border crossing where I've been this whole time. Have just kind of shown up, and the rest of it's been done up to this point by individuals and volunteers.
So, Mike, why are you there, and what have you been spending your time doing over these past few weeks?
Well, for the last 6 years, I've really put my focus on understanding and co-creating spaces with displaced people. And this is, like we said, the largest displacement event of a generation. So, I really wanted to be here to witness it and to see where I could help out. I was deployed here by Alight as part of their rapid response team. Alight is the former American Refugee Committee. They spent a few years working with IDEO, who is known for this human-centered design process, to reimagine what an aid organization can be to respond to the current times of humanitarian needs.
And what are you spending your time doing there? What does your workday look like? I know that you're working all the time and you're having really long days with a lot of high stress environments, you're working with a lot of people who are coming out of a war-torn country. What are you spending your days doing?
Yeah, each day is a bit different. When I first got here, it was complete chaos. It's also very cold. The lines to get across the border have been up to 5 kilometers long, which can take over 30 hours. And it's way below freezing here. And you have predominantly, well, almost all women and children and elderly. And so a lot of our efforts were just in trying to keep people warm and safe and alive when doing the crossing. And the weather is warming up a bit right now. Systems are getting a bit more in place. We have more infrastructure on site. For example, there was only 2 tents when I first arrived. And so when people are outside, there was no way to get them inside. And now we have some massive party tents, like the same kind of thing you'd see at Coachella, you know, or at a wedding. And we're going through $2,500 a day on fuel, diesel to heat these tents. So, you know, in the beginning, it was emergency response. And really, it was just about keeping people warm. And now that it's a bit more beefed up as far as response, now it's about coordination and trying to centralize some of our infrastructure and also, you know, having systems in place which keep people safe. One of the big things you have to worry about in all borders have nefarious activities, but especially when you have this many vulnerable people, you have to worry about human trafficking. And when I first got here, there was these transition centers that were just people walking around with cardboard signs saying, I'll, you know, ride or, you know, have seats for 4 people to go to Berlin or to Copenhagen or Warsaw or Krakow. And they were just announcing on a microphone, hey, who wants to go to Berlin? Who wants to go to Portugal? You know, and they were just matching, you know, finding people. But that's a huge protection risk. And now there's a much more in place system where we're registering drivers, we're finding out where people want to go, we're verifying that people give their information. And so, yeah, it's really been this ever evolving situation where this just happened so quick. There wasn't necessarily a warning. I know some people knew that, you know, there was the buildup of Russians on the Ukraine border, but the flow of people just was not, it wasn't ready. Like IOM, for example, is a UN agency for migration. They had a presence here in Poland, but they did not have an emergency response team or the scale to be able to handle what this is. So yeah, I mean, every day is different. Today, I've actually left the border for the first time in, you know, weeks because I'm going to see my family to celebrate my dad's 70th birthday with all of our family. So it's never a good time to leave. It's always really hard to pull myself away from these situations, but it's also really important to, one, give yourself a little bit of downtime, and two, step out of the raging river and gain some perspective.
Well, and Mike, we're going to talk about self-care in the context of this kind of work, because within our friendship, that's been something that's come up a lot. Like I'm always pushing you on self-care, as you know, and that's something that I think is so important when we're looking at this kind of service and the fatigue that can come along with it, and indeed the trauma for volunteers. Particularly, you're talking about people who are just regular Polish folks, people just coming to the border trying to help out, and that self-care is so important. We'll get to that a little bit later, but I want to start with you and how you got to this place. And like many of the guests on this show who do amazing work in the world, you yourself started in nightlife. And I think that that's an excellent starting place because you've gone on a beautiful journey of gathering people and creating spaces for people. So let's go back to the temple days and let's talk about your first involvement with creating space for people to flourish.
Yeah, my first kind of job after graduating and traveling for a bit was doing green building, where we were making really nice residential houses for wealthy people that were green. And I really didn't think that that was going to meet the scale of the challenge that we're facing with climate change and environmental challenges. And so I linked up with Paul Hemming, who was opening a nightclub that he was calling Temple Nightclub. And he really liked the fact that I was coming with progressive ideas on how to use buildings as environmental showcases and create environments where people were able to think differently about the environment. And I became the director of sustainability of Temple Nightclub that opened in 2007. And we had a number of different programs started around minimizing our usage. So of energy, water, and waste. We had a 92% diversion from landfill. We got a number of other bars, nightclubs, and restaurants to participate in these programs before it was required by the city of San Francisco. Then we also had innovative things like an energy-generating dance floor and a rooftop beehive and a greenhouse on the roof and vermicompost and solar and vertical gardens. But the third thing was about letting people use our space for environmental causes or just good causes in general, because we were making our money Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night throwing parties. But then we had this 40,000 square foot building, which was largely vacant the rest of the time. And we just became a center of the budding sustainability movement that was just taking off in San Francisco, and wound up hosting hundreds of free events over the years for people to utilize the assets that we had of a liquor license and a sound system and projectors and a dance floor, and really made a lot of good friends in the city and helped people out and, you know, got to establish ourselves as, you know, what is a business that is sustainable? You know, how can you utilize your assets in a way that is productive for different causes?
And this work of creating space that people could utilize, and they could utilize with their own sovereignty in a non-transactional way, in a decommodified way. This reminds me of your work with Free Space in San Francisco. Can you share just a little bit about Free Space before we move into your work with displaced populations?
Yeah, these free events without a bar minimum and just offering our space really laid the groundwork for Free Space. Free Space came out of the National Day of Civic Hacking, which was a White House and NASA and other governmental agencies to do a hackathon over a weekend for improving community. But in order to win a hackathon, you want to kind of hack the hackathon. So instead of doing just a weekend, we decided to do a whole month. And we were able to secure a building in San Francisco that was, you know, on the market for $26,000 a month for just a dollar for the month of June in 2013. And we just opened up our doors and had the principles of no money, no alcohol, everyone's a participant, and no ego, no logo. And with that, we unleashed this abundance of engagement and participation and wound up doing 119 events in our first 30 days. We wound up covering the walls with art and filling the building with couches and sound systems and bike repair and gardens and just so many things that were just, I mean, even, you know, in the first 11 days, we transformed this kind of like, you know, I think it was a 14,000 square foot warehouse and parking lot that was abandoned into this really beautiful gallery of, you know, user generated physical space in a sense and an indoor commons. And that project was very successful. We wound up getting recognized as one of the winners of the hackathon and got invited to the White House as champions of change. And that concept got a lot of attention. We got a lot of press, and we wound up getting inquiries from all over the world to do free spaces in different cities. And so in the next year, I think we did another 10 locations. And over the next 2 years from when we started, we're in 14 different countries and did it around 26 different iterations. So this was really this kind of unleashing of letting community have access to temporary space that is not being utilized. And yeah, we just saw this abundance of new ideas. And what was really great about it is it was different everywhere you go. And it wasn't imposing, you know, our San Francisco hackathon methodology. It was really just, here's a space, what do you guys want to do with it? And it really got filled with whatever that is that the local people cared about. And, you know, Detroit, for example, is a city that's very hard to show up as an outsider because they're sick of that. But, you know, we didn't show up and say, here's what you have to do. It was just, here's a space, what are some challenges that the community is facing, and utilize this space for that purpose. And when you remove money from the equation, you really get to see what people are passionate about. And you really kind of get to, you know, down to the root of what some of the biggest challenges are. And yeah, it was a amazing project that met so many people and so many people made happen. And, you know, relationships and babies and tattoos and all these things have come out of Free Spaces.
So I'm starting to hear some of what you have been pursuing over many years. You've been building a toolkit around the utilization of space for empowered participation. And that's something that Roots and Temple, Free Space, and then in a very big way, in Uhuru Land in Uganda. And so we can see this kind of evolution of your work from like a hacker space into refugee camps and ultimately leading to the work that you're doing on the border now and the continuing innovation of your ideas. So as a way of getting into your own experience of working with refugees, I'd love for you to share a little bit about how these principles of engagement began to form. I'm already hearing it as you're talking about these decommodified spaces and particularly this piece on participation. But can you share a little bit about your connection with Uganda, how, your first trip, how you went there for the World Cup in 2010, and kind of like how these principles started to coalesce that have become really iconic to your approach to serving refugee populations?
Yeah, through my work at Temple Nightclub, I met Keith Agoda at Glide Memorial, whose brother was working for UNICEF at the time. And he just saw how I was kind of creating these free events and thought that I would be a good person to send to Uganda to do a series of screenings that were happening around the continent for the World Cup happening in South Africa, which was the first time that the soccer World Cup was happening in Africa. And not everyone can travel to it. So they wanted to create a way for people to also participate in this celebration of, you know, the most popular game on the planet. So I went with an inflatable projector screen and showed the World Cup in an area of Kampala called Chebando, and would get huge crowds of people to show up for this free screening. And at halftime, we'd turn off the game and we'd have a little open mic session and say, what are some challenges that we're facing in this community? And what are your ideas to deal with it? And then the next day we'd meet up and do something about it, whether it was a cleanup or road safety. And then we'd come back the next day and show pictures at halftime again and say, here's what we did yesterday. Would you like to join us? Should we do something else? And through that process, we really were able to uncover what some of the biggest challenges facing that immediate community, which happened to be road safety. There was a highway that was just put in about 100 or 200 yards away from where we were screening, and people were getting hit. Children were crossing to get to school. People were going to work. And it was literally the most dangerous intersection, or it wasn't even an intersection. It was the dangerous crossing in the whole country. And so we wound up putting in place a crossing guard. We wound up doing a big protest. And many years later, there is now a pedestrian bridge that crosses it. But that was something that I never could have known about without having asked. Because, you know, I showed up there as this bright-eyed humanitarian, my first trip to Africa, trying to do good, wanted to pick up all the plastic. But really what the biggest challenge was people were losing their lives because of this road. And so that's really been one of the tools and methodologies that I've relied on is leading with culture. Whatever it is that's going to get people to show up, then you get a diverse group of people with an understanding of what's happening in a place. And just by asking, what can we do to improve this place, you wind up getting much better answers than if you just show up somewhere and impose what you think is needed.
What year did you first go to Burning Man?
2006.
I really feel like this participation piece of festival culture, the idea that we kind of come to celebrate and we build together and we create together and everyone has a kind of joint ownership and there's a sort of like bonding that occurs in that environment reminds me a lot of the work that you've done with refugee environments and creating celebration. You've just said that you're leading with culture, bringing people together to watch the World Cup and then coming together to co-create solutions and empower people to participate in those solutions. To me, that kind of reminds me of Burning Man, and I'm curious whether Burning Man was influential in the evolution of your philosophy in working with refugees.
Yeah, absolutely. Burning Man has been life-changing for myself and many who go there. But when I was at Burning Man, I always saw it as practice for the default world. And I also say that I'm officially a part of an unofficial department at Burning Man called the Other 51 Weeks. It was at Larry Harvey's funeral celebration at Burning Man, where Reverend Billy said, "It's not about what happens on the playa. Now is the time to take it to the other 51 weeks." And I just really love that term. And even, you know, when I first started going to Burning Man, we were already building Temple Nightclub, where we were trying to figure out what is this urban modern temple that we can attract youth and active people to improve their communities. And yeah, Burning Man was always just kind of practice to bring it out into the default world.
Okay, so from temple to free space, you spent this time in Uganda where you were understanding the way that you could lead with culture. I'm curious how these different touch points then evolved into a more formal relationship with working with refugees. How did free space then evolve? Where did you go next?
Yeah, so I was contacted by a wealthy philanthropist who had been giving money to a large NGO to deal with the Syrian migrant crisis in Europe, in Greece. And he flew to Lesbos to see where all his money was going and just saw chaos there and really said to himself, "I guess we're going to have to do this ourselves." And so I was contacted because they were looking for somebody who had experience in creating new type of spaces, but had never picked up the bad habits of working in the refugee humanitarian space. So they put me in touch with Ahmed Khan and basically sent me around Greece, Lesbos, the islands, Turkey, just to witness what was currently going on and how refugee camps were being set up, and said, "Please make something different, make something new." And so, a la Free Space, we wound up getting a former blue jean factory, a big abandoned warehouse, and using only, you know, refugees and volunteers, recreating that into a refugee camp by adding walls and doors and windows, like I'm sure the, you know, room that you're going to sleep in tonight is, and giving people dignity by allowing them to cook for themselves and adding art. You know, we had over 1,000 volunteers from Europe and really created what was by far the most dignified and best refugee camp in all of Greece. And that's because it was created by people who really cared about it. And we did bring in professionals when we opened to run medical and psychosocial, like mental health and things like that. But everything was done without NGOs. And so that was really a illuminating and thing to me. And the other crazy thing, not only was it so much better, we also spent less than half per person than these outdoor tent cities. And that really just blew my mind that by just getting people together in this participatory nature that really cared and were passionate about coming here to help people, that we were able to outperform the much more funded and experienced professionals who were trying to deal with the same situation.
Has that model then been replicated in other environments after the work you did in Greece? Has that kind of like taken off in other places?
Well, it's no secret in the humanitarian sector that big change is needed. And this whole notion of dependency is just not, it doesn't pencil out. It's too expensive per person. It's degrading. It's lacking of agency. And so everyone in the humanitarian sector knows that something has to change. But these are well-established organizations. They have this humanitarian industrial complex thing going on where they, you know, perpetuate some of these dependency models. There was a conference in 2016 in Istanbul, the World Humanitarian Summit, and they gathered all of these different groups. And their conclusion was, it has to be refugee-led. But how to transition to that is a slow evolving process. That's one of the reasons why I really like working with Alight, which is the former American Refugee Committee, because they've identified this need to find others is one of their principles. And the others are the refugees themselves. And again, it's still a lot of the funding is still coming from U.S. government and the EU and different programs. And it's difficult to break from the current method of doing things, but there's a lot of groups that are trying. It's just a slowly evolving process. So that's why having private funds allows you to support refugee-led initiatives. But just the reporting requirements alone, the grant writing, the reporting, everything that's needed to get this government money is so arduous that it would actually cripple a refugee-led organization that has the capacity to deal with the problems that they're trying to solve. But you know, there isn't that paperwork and all the things that come with trying to get some of that money. So that's one of the things, trying to figure out how to almost buy capacity from organizations with know-how to do it, but then can transfer the agency and the funds to refugee-led groups.
I remember around this time, I'm pretty sure it was around this time, you reached out to me and you said, I've got a great idea. Tell me if this is feasible. You wanted to throw a festival in Greece, have a bunch of burners and like festival people come, build a temporary city to celebrate in. And then instead of taking it down like you do at the end of Burning Man, but actually like invite refugees to then live in those spaces and potentially have those refugees come to celebrate and build and be part of the festival too. I remember at the time we couldn't figure out how to put that together. I'm curious if that's still something that you'd like to create and what might be necessary to make something like that. Because I think that for some of our listeners, that seems like an exciting way of doing things.
Yeah, the Leave a Trace Festival. Yeah, and I've seen how refugee camps are set up in many different countries. And I definitely believe that the burner way of laying out a grid, letting the participants come and pop things up is something that I would like to see up against the current ways of doing things. And I'm pretty sure that it would be more cost-effective, more celebratory, more joyful. We're looking at potentially 500 million to a billion displaced people in the next 30 years. There's currently mid 80 million. This has now changed all in the last couple of weeks because of the Ukraine war. There's going to be a need for a massive amount of housing in the next 30 years. And whether that's done with the current methodology or whether we get to try other things out, Leave a Trace is one possible idea. There's other ideas of putting a makerspace in the middle of a city and letting people show up and build their own city. There's incremental development, which is the Paul Romer philosophy of allowing people to only start with corrugated metal or tents if they can, and eventually build up to more permanent infrastructure, but doing it laid out in a way that there's a grid and a plan. Because that's the problem with informal settlements or shanty towns, that it's basically people who are squatting and they don't ever add on to their assets because they could be removed at any time. And if you have this massive amount of population that hasn't been settled with an urban plan in place, it's very difficult to add infrastructure like power and sewers and other things that make a well-thriving city. So yes, I would definitely say Leave a Trace is something that I'm very interested in. There's a number of people who are interested in it because I think we need to try many different things, and we need to get as many people involved as possible. And unleashing the creativity that comes with the festival world is one of those assets, you know, like the, you know, roadies and production people and veterans, you know, they're all really good at kind of problem solving. And in fact, the person who's running the largest border crossing for the Ukraine crisis is a filmmaker who runs film sets. So, you know, there's a lot of skill sets that come from being able to manage a site, flows of people, information, wayfinding, food, bathrooms. All of these things are present in temporary cities and also in, you know, long-term planned cities as well.
Well, so let's talk about Uhuru Land, which is a space within a 64-year-old refugee camp in Uganda. You were just talking about these temporary spaces where people aren't able to build things because they're temporary. So 64 years does not sound particularly temporary. And it's one of the largest, maybe it's the largest refugee space in Africa?
No, it's the oldest. It's one of the oldest refugee camps in the world. It's about 160,000 people. There's another camp in Uganda, which is called Bidi Bidi, which is filled with people from South Sudan. That's a little over 300,000. That was the largest refugee camp in the world until the Rohingya situation in Burma fled to Bangladesh, which is now the largest refugee camp in the world, is 1.2 million people. But Naki Vale is the camp that I've mostly been focused on. It's actually referred to as a settlement. And that's known as one of the oldest refugee camps in the world.
And so what is Uhuru Land? I heard you once say that your colleagues and you kind of like dropped a playa into a refugee camp. I'd love to hear you describe that, because your work with Patrick in Uganda has been pivotal for your life and has been kind of the workshop where you've done so much experimentation and innovation on some of these ideas. So let's talk a bit about Uhuru Land and what you learned there and how that created the kind of dignity, art, and community that is so important in these potentially temporary spaces.
Yeah, so after my experience in Greece, where we co-created this dignified, decent living space for refugees, I was really interested to travel around the world and learn more about global human displacement. And the first place I went was back to Uganda, which I'd already been to 6 years prior. And went to check out this refugee settlement called Naki Vale. And I was driving around in the NGO vehicles and going and stopping at different places, but I saw a house that was made out of plastic bottles. And I, you know, said, stop the vehicle, and got out and met Patrick Mavunga. And it happened to be the opening day of a community space that they had created called Opportunity. Opportunity plus refugee. And my intention was to go there and set up some type of community space. But of course, it's much better if locals already are doing that themselves, because when you leave, you know, if they're not into it, the project's going to die. And so it would just happen to be really great timing. And the founder of it is Patrick Mavunga, who I've been partners with in many different projects and initiatives over the last, I guess, 5 years now. And the tour wanted to keep going along, and I said, no, just leave me here. This is what I came here for. And, you know, they said, no, we can't leave you here. And I'm like, well, just, you know, we have to go back for lunch to the secure location. And I'm like, well, tell him I wouldn't leave. And I was really excited to meet Patrick, hearing his ideas of what, you know, his idea of community space was about and the principles that they were coming up with of non-hierarchical and doing a lot of really impressive work of active listening and nonviolent communication and conflict resolution, and coming at it with this kind of social innovation mindset. And so I exchanged phone numbers with him, Facebook and WhatsApp, and wound up coming back on my own and living with Patrick and his family inside of this refugee settlement for some time. So after spending time with Patrick, we came up with this idea to make a larger space that could hold more community. And the idea was Uhuru Land, which is the Swahili word for freedom. And Uhuru Land is essentially a mix of the playa and ancient Greece urban planning. It has an amphitheater, a library, the polis, you know, a place to sit and talk, and plants and bees and all these different things that are a place for refugees to create their own projects. And this initiative was supported originally by Habitas Rise, which is their give back program, and utilizing their expertise in hosting people and creating innovative structures. And it's really become this gathering place, much like the playa, where you kind of set the boundaries and then all of these other groups can come in and set up their particular projects or refugees. There's bees there, that's called Refubee. There's the Shadow Man, which is a kind of radio station recording studio done by TO.org. There's Promise Hub, which is kind of inside the library, which is this makerspace, innovation, prototyping lab. And all of this happens with the anchor really being the amphitheater, which is as old as society, the one to many. And much like free space, not projecting, this is what should happen here, it gets filled with their culture. There's dancing and talent shows and music and weddings and movies, and everything happens at this world, at this amphitheater. And that's really, again, utilizing culture to draw people in. And then once they're there, they can also learn, hey, you can also participate in this project where you can try and come up with solutions, or you can, you know, sit and relax on these like art chairs that are made by Shrine, who created the temple at Burning Man many years ago, Sagrada Basura. It's a really wonderful space that generally inside of these refugee settlements, they don't have this kind of public space and this infrastructure, this cultural infrastructure to be able to celebrate and spend time with each other. And I, like I said earlier, it's difficult to know what a solution to any complex problem is, but the only thing that seems to work is to, that I've seen, that I have faith in, is to gather people and have them collectively figure it out together. And that's what Uhuru Land is, an experiment that's been very successful and has a ton of engagement and is this colorful, open, green space inside of this 64-year-old refugee camp called Naki Valley.
I'm so inspired by Uhuru Land. I love the name too. And I love that you've had the opportunity along with Patrick and others to visualize an entire reimagining of a refugee camp and bringing, you know, as we've discussed, real dignity through participation and through art and creativity in that space. So we're looking at Uhuru Land in the middle of the 64-year-old refugee camp. And I imagine that that's an entirely different workspace than something like this acute situation in Ukraine leading to a mass displacement across the Polish border. How have you taken this toolkit you've been developing over many years, your work in Free Space, Greece, Uganda, also Bangladesh, the U.S.-Mexico border, how are you bringing some of these tools to this Polish border, and what has been unexpected there? What are you learning in this different environment that is so much more acute and fast moving than what has been happening in some of the other environments you've been?
So in Uganda and in Greece, really strive to empower and transfer agency to the refugees to build. And that's this principle of finding others. In this context here in Poland, where we have Ukrainians and non-Ukrainians coming across the border in historic numbers, the others are the volunteers. The refugees themselves are really just trying to get across the border and further into Europe. So there's no time to ask them, hey, how would you like to, you know, build this center? Really, it's about individuals who have just shown up. The Polish people were the first people here because they were local. They just happened to be present, and there was no ability for the large organizations to mount a response and to get all the paperwork needed to organize a response to this. And in the meantime, there were hundreds of thousands of people arriving, you know, even in the first week. So I think my approach of trying to support non-traditional humanitarians, and in that case, in Uganda, it being refugees, and in Greece, it being also refugees. In this case, it's really about supporting the volunteers. So when I came to Poland, I started a similar way of joining the rapid response team here and doing an assessment. We first flew into Warsaw, and just through networks, some of them being Burning Man, was introduced to some Polish Americans, or some Americans who've been living in Poland for 30 years. And, you know, that's always one of the first things you do. You got to find a fixer. You got to find someone who's familiar with the cultural context. Diplomats and ambassadors call it like cultural attaché. We just call it fixers. Nothing I do in a place where I'm not from, I'm never successful without a good fixer. So that's how you find your rides, where not to go. You get some, you know, hey, here's some ideas we have. No, those ones won't work here. Or, hey, that could actually be something. So just a sounding board. And then we drove around to the border crossings and went to visit several border crossings, went to some of the reception centers and just observed, talked to people, asked questions. And that's how our assessment started here. The situation on the ground was complete chaos. We got here March 1st, and people were just, there were so many people, and we were going around and kind of asked, like, who's in charge here? you know, that was the theme of this assessment. And we're like, nobody? Really? Because that's usually what happens when there's something like this. There's a coordinated response. There's agencies who are, you know, in charge. And that was really what was so shocking, to see this massive amount of people and space and signs and drivers and rides and luggage and beds and everything, food, but no one was in charge. And that was kind of the theme of this, is the first week of assessment. Who's in charge? Nobody, really. And went to the Medeka border crossing, which is kind of become the largest border crossing because its proximity and connection via train and highways to Lviv, which is the largest Western Ukraine city. This is Medeka crossing seemed to be, there was just a constant flow of people, thousands and thousands per day were just crossing, and there was really no infrastructure set up to support them. There was only two tents. One was Rescuers Without Borders medical tent, and the other were these black film tents that were brought by, I learned later, a Polish guy named Nicholas, who helped make movies happen. So he happened to have tents, generators, tables and chairs for craft services, and he would do photo shoots and raves in abandoned warehouses and just had this infrastructure and showed up and set them up. And he's now become the coordinator for the largest border crossing in Poland, who 3 weeks ago was a filmmaker. And he actually just did an interview on TV where he was supposed to be doing a film set, and he told them on, you know, national Polish TV that he's not going to make it because he's a little bit busy right now. And there's a lot of people that just showed up and had never done any of this work before and wound up doing really heroic work and really impressive work. And so, yeah, my role here is simply to try and help coordinate, which is not an easy task because you have all these individual actors showing up here. And, you know, also just navigating the different situations. It can be as simple as helping someone. I mean, there's so many different things that come up every hour. You just have someone come up to you and say, hey, I just showed up from Portugal. We have three vans of medical equipment and donations for children. And you say, great, let's put those over here.
It makes me think of something that you said when we were talking, when we were preparing for this and talking about your experience there, is you were saying that all the media, all the cameras are pointing east, and you wish that they would point their cameras west and they could see this extraordinary humanitarian outpouring, all of these people showing up to support Ukrainians and non-Ukrainian residents of Ukraine crossing the border. And I think that that's so inspiring and really deserves, you know, part of this podcast is to point a camera west to the people that are showing up to help.
Yeah, Medeka is the busiest crossing, and therefore it's attracted all sorts of actors and stakeholders, one of those being the media. Every night when I come home, whenever I have the chance to watch some news about what's happening and they cover refugees, I see Medeka. And there's sometimes more press than volunteers. And some of them are very aggressive. And there's a concept of ethical journalism in covering refugees and migrants that I don't think they've all read. And there's kind of this, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. This like flies in the eyes is another way they say, like showing these depressing images to the world. And it's very important for the world to see what's happening. But it's also important for people to be welcomed with dignity. And we're trying to work on ways to still allow for freedom of the press and for the world to get to witness what's happening, but also to do it in a respectful, dignified way for the traumatized people who've just been displaced from their country and are going through a really, you know, hard time. So most of, you know, there's just been this outpouring of support offered. Like when you're coming through, you're getting offered a hat if you're cold, a blanket, we have medical care. There's even tents set up for animals that have dog food and collars and veterinarians. The only ambulance we have on site 24 hours a day is for animals because people are taking their animals with them. Sometimes we'll get in like, I don't know, 30 animals at once because during the bombs, some of the animals run away from home and they get scared and then people need to leave. So there's been a tremendous mobilization just around animals. So just to showcase, you know, that's, you know, you ask what's a day like. Sometimes it's like, hey, we got 6 cats and 5 dogs coming in. You have to figure out how to bring them across the border and then where do they go? And yeah, it's really interesting how just this response has been organic and has, I guess, responded to the varied nature of what arrives here. And I really do wish that the cameras, sometimes they're even blocking the entrance to Poland because there's so many of them, like paparazzi. And, you know, especially if it's a, you know, an old person in a wheelchair or a kid in a stretcher. And it's really kind of disgusting to me. But I really wish that some of them, instead of pointing their cameras east and showing the faces of the people coming in, that they would simply turn 180 degrees and show what the refugees are experiencing, which is a tremendous amount of care, that people are like welcoming their own family and they're offering them tea and food and blankets and hats and toys and singing happy birthday to this 8-year-old girl who passed the other night and just all of this care. But really, that's not what the media is showing. They're really kind of zooming in and not asking for consent for photos or children. And yeah, it's, I think that these places bring out the best and the worst in people. And I wouldn't say the media is the worst. I just am a little, you know, as a humanitarian who's here to help make the process safe and dignified, the press seem to be working against that in some ways. But really, I mean, the worst of humanity is people who prey on vulnerable people, and there's human trafficking that's going on. And that's where right now, 3 weeks in, some of the larger organizations have gotten their paperwork in order, gotten their government approvals, gotten their funding set up, and they're just starting to show up. And even today was the first meeting that IOM, the International Organization for Migration, hosted the coordination meeting, and we, you know, are beginning to draft the relevant rules and guidelines for the Medeka border crossing. And that's necessary. I do love the informal volunteers and the passion they bring, but there's also something to be said for the experience and the coordination for dealing with something on this scale to make sure that people aren't open to risk as much as possible. That's one of the major humanitarian sectors, is just called protection. And it's looking after vulnerable cases. It's trying to protect people that are in vulnerable situations. They've just left their husbands and their sons and fathers behind. A lot of them have a bunch of cash on them because they're not sure about how the banking system is going to work in Europe. And there's just a lot of chaos. There's an unknown of where they're going. And so if you have someone offering rides, offering a place to stay, Europe doesn't want to set up camps for this situation. So it's largely falling on the citizens of Europe to self-organize housing, rides, handling of the border process, the reception centers. All of this is kind of being self-organized. And again, there's beautiful things about that, but there's also something to be said for installing some systems. And I think we're right now, 3.5 weeks in, just starting to see some of that come into focus.
And so you were talking about how this is more of a crossing than like a camp, and in terms of infrastructure, what's being built. But are there more permanent things that are coming into place here in terms of resources for people and that sort of thing? Are things kind of like sprouting up that you feel like are going to be there for a while? Or is it just facilitating people crossing the border?
I mean, I've mostly been focused on the border. That just through the assessment that we did, I just felt that that was where there was a great need. But this is a long-term, difficult situation. Right now, we're kind of in the honeymoon phase, where people are opening up their houses and hosting people, but you know, house guests get old. And when we deal with like a mass displacement in Uganda, It's like 50,000 people arrive and then they're going to live there. So you have to deal with all of these other things like long-term housing, education, livelihoods, healthcare. Right now, in this emergency response, most of my time has been spent at the border. And we're just trying to make sure people get from the other side, where there's a huge long line, through the border crossing, and then onto buses or meeting up with family and friends to get further on into Europe. And that's where this is right now at the top of the news cycle. There's a lot of donations coming in, but this is going to be a protracted situation. And like I said, some of these issues that are more long-term are going to be a lot of work, and a lot of it's falling to, again, is distributed amongst citizens to host people in their homes, to provide rides, to do things. And so, yeah, this is a long-term thing. We're just getting people from the border further into Europe, but it's already backing up in Warsaw. Warsaw has 10% of their population now is Ukrainian, and people are piling up at the train stations, and even Berlin, I've heard, is getting overwhelmed by the number of people. So we're in the very beginning phases of a long response that's needed.
And what do you think your role will continue to be? I know that you're going to be going to the UK to be with your family for a little while. Are you going to be heading back to the border? What kind of deployment can you expect moving forward?
Yeah, I'm leaving just for 3 or 4 days. And I still think there's a lot of work to be done at this Medeka crossing as we formalize our systems. And I'm also really, my partner, Liana, who's been on this show before, will also be coming back with me. And I'm interested to see how that may settle things down a bit, that I'll be able to go home and have dinner and not just be 20 hours a day responding to everything and adrenaline, and because that's really not a sustainable way to deal with a situation. There's adrenaline deficit disorder, there's adjacent trauma, there's different things that really affect people. If you try and stay in this mode for many months, it's one thing to do it for an initial emergency response, but again, this is not looking like the war is going to end anytime soon, so there's going to be a need. You know, the border is still kind of this focal point, but there's also a huge need. And once that kind of gets stabilized, there's a huge need to the east by providing support inside Ukraine. And then there's a huge need to the west by dealing with some of the more long-term issues that I was just talking about, of livelihood, long-term housing, education, mental health support. And, you know, that is a huge need is inside of Ukraine. So one of the things that's been going on here, TO.org has provided a former ambulance and doesn't have any of the beds and stuff inside of it, but it's now a medical supply distribution vehicle. There's another one of the kind of core team of coordinators and organizers here at Medeka is a Polish woman, 28 years old, was a computer programmer just 3 weeks ago and is now a coordinator and also an ambulance driver, where they're getting medical supplies that are being requested from Ukraine. And then they drive them across the border into Lviv, where there's a distribution center that then sends them either around Lviv or further east into Ukraine. And that's a huge effort right now. Getting cars across the border could take 10 hours, could take 30 hours. And so Ustina, who is now the ambulance driver, they needed a stretcher to be brought over to the Ukraine side to help somebody get over to Poland. And she thought, hey, if we can take a stretcher through the border control, maybe we could also take a shopping cart. And there happens to be a shopping center right at the border crossing, and we've borrowed pretty much all of their shopping carts now. And now there's huge runs of, you know, sometimes 10, 15 shopping carts pushing food, tea, medical supplies across the border to load up vehicles on the Ukraine side to then go in. So this was something that Justina came up with and now is used by everyone from World Central Kitchen to United Sikhs, and all the different groups are kind of utilizing the shopping cart method. And because it's an open border still, I've been across, I think, 4 times. And there's coordination happening between the Ukrainian side of the border and the Polish side of the border on a humanitarian basis. You know, the U.S. military can't go into Ukraine and the Polish military can't go into Ukraine, but humanitarians can. And so there's this really interesting cross-border communication that's happening. And there's a Polish gentleman who showed up to try and help out over there, who also happened to be a computer programmer, who's now kind of running the operations over there. So there's this whole kind of informal organization which has emerged that's simply handling the humanitarian affairs of this mass movement. That's something that I've never seen before. There's also people, it really does seem like a festival. To use the name of your show, there's like a group of Scottish Shioban Trust that has prayer flags on their tent, and they have a wood-fired pizza oven and are walking around with the big, you know, wooden spatulas handing out pizza to people. And there's all these pop-up tents and food trucks that kind of has this, you know, almost like an Austin hipster, you know, food truck park thing going on. And many people, when they arrive here, say it looks like a festival. And I think there's a lot of good that comes from welcoming people with joy and having this kind of environment that's much different than usually the sterile, very process-oriented NGO response. That's unique to this situation versus other places I've worked.
When you told me that there were site maps of the area that were actually made by festival producers, that there are actually people who work in festivals who are participating in creating a more cohesive celebratory environment. Is that the case?
Yeah. I mean, when we first got here, it was really emergency response. How do we keep people warm and not exposed to the cold? And so we're just kind of scrambling. But then after we got a little bit more infrastructure and tents, we started to move into camp coordination and management, which involves site mapping as one of those things. And this was just a park. This was just a pedestrian way that now, you know, had two tents and now has 80. So how do you coordinate the location of the power and the water and the trash and all these different things? And so a good friend of mine, Kevin Rowell, who used to, you know, run the operations for the Dew Lab and Lightning in a Bottle, I sent him some satellite images from Planet Labs, and he was able to work with one of his site mappers to come up with the first site plan that we've had of Medeka that we now have up on the walls of our office. And we're able to utilize that to be able to identify who's on site, where they should be, where, you know, where we need to reshuffle things, have medical over here, have food over here, have toilets, all these different things. That's very similar to mapping out a festival.
I love the fact that people who have created temporary spaces for joy are creating temporary spaces that are coming out of some of the most intense suffering happening in the world, and they're creating this warm, welcoming space. I love the vision of like the pizza oven and taking care of the pets, and there's something that is so beautifully human about showing up and taking care of people in these extraordinary crises.
And even just the term humanitarian only being reserved for people who work for NGOs. I mean, caring for other humans is kind of just a human trait. And you really do see the best of people come out when there's a need, when there's a crisis. You know, this whole group of informal volunteers, like I had mentioned, Nicholas, who was the filmmaker, and Justina, who is a computer programmer. There's all these people that have just shown up. And what's been really interesting to see too is that they've formed a logo, which is the Polish flag with the Ukrainian flag in the shape of, you know, the plus sign or like the Red Cross, kind of signifying aid. And they've also come up with the term or the name for their group is Borders Without Borders. And so Yeah, and we're right on the border and trying to, it's a good name. And so that's become this overarching logo and name for this informal response. And so even though the larger organizations have just showed up and are starting to put in place some structure and camp management, this group of Borders Without Borders, they are the ones that the police go to when there's a problem because they've been here and they know how things work. You know, they're the ones that have centralized the power grid. So instead of every group that's here, every tent that's here, having their own generator and having to run out to get fuel and everything, we've gotten two major generators and run a power grid from that. So like all of these things are being coordinated. So it's not that the large organizations can just show up and replace this, because they need the capacity, they need the people, they need the understanding. And so that's what's also been really unique about this, is that individual volunteers have coalesced into an organization, and none of these people are going to go back to their former jobs. You know, volunteers that show up here, they have left their apartments in Warsaw and they've left their jobs. They've dropped everything because this is the most important thing in their world. And that's what's so, not only the proximity that they have to a crisis, that local actors are so important, but also just, you know, you have to pull them away after some weeks and say, hey, you need to take a day off. Whereas a lot of people who come here for jobs, they work 9 to 5, Monday through Friday, but the border is open 24/7 and there's flows of people coming 24/7. So, you know, there's really something important about allowing the individual actors to be able to remain. And one of those things is to coordinate and to formalize and to become legal. And yeah, and that's happening at a really quick pace, because I've seen it happen where when the formal organizations show up, they start to push out the volunteers, and then you lose a bit of the heart. You know, you lose a bit of that sparkle that comes with passionate people who dropped everything and came to be here.
Mike, that brings us to where I'd like to end this conversation here, which has to do with self-care in the context of disaster relief and service in these intense environments. You're talking about how you have to pull these people away. You've spoken about your own 20-hour days. You and I have spoken separately from this podcast about how demanding this has been on you and how much self-discipline is necessary in order to actually get this sleep that you need to succeed and to support this. And I think that there's a certain kind of cultural dynamic that often happens in these environments where there is so much suffering, there's so much that's needed there, that the people who show up just run themselves to the bone trying to support. And you and I have known each other for a long time, and I feel like as your friend, I'm always trying to promote your self-care and you're an incredible resource for so many people. You're doing such incredible work, and you got to be taking care of yourself. So I'm curious, like in this environment, as you've grown and matured as a person and in your service and in your dharma, what does self-care look like for you now? And you are going away for a couple of days. You're coming back. Liana's going to be with you. How can you create the boundaries in your life so that you can be the most effective you can be in your role, but you also can get real sleep and eat and take care of yourself?
Yeah, I don't know if I have the answer for myself yet. It will be a work in progress. But
why don't you tell me what you think others should do, and maybe I can wrestle you into applying it to yourself by the end of this conversation.
Yeah, so one, it's very demanding work, and this particular response has been extremely cold, and even wearing like 3 jackets and tights and boots and gloves and hats and everything, just being outside for 12, 14 hours a day, standing the entire time, not sleeping, is really, people are getting sick. There's COVID, actually. Some people have gotten COVID here. And yeah, this has been a very demanding response. And self-care is difficult to find around here, especially amongst the volunteers who just showed up. There's so much passion. There's so much need that your own self-care just doesn't really come into play. People are not sleeping. They're outside in the cold for 10, 14 hours a day. You know, lack of sleep, stress. And people almost feel guilty taking time off or sleeping or caring for themselves. And this is a common theme, especially amongst people who are new humanitarians, and also people who, including myself, who have some experience but are responding to an emergency situation. The need is so great, the stakes are so high, that your own needs really do take a backseat. And I'm trying to learn to be different with it. And it's an evolving process. But one of the things that we're doing on site here is creating a volunteer kind of wellness space. My friends at IRL contacted me and asked, you know, how could they support the work here? And I said, you know what? I think looking after the wellness of the volunteers would be really helpful. And we came up with this concept with Benja and Natalie Stone to create a recharge room. This is something that has been seen in medical environments to help medical professionals deal with the stress of COVID. And they're creating these kind of vibey spaces with nice lighting and comfortable couches and letting people take a break to be able to recharge and to go back and do this difficult work. So we're in the process of creating a lounge inside of the border crossing. And this is difficult because making something nice and comfortable, everyone wants to donate to help the refugees. But the work that the volunteers bear on their shoulders and the burnout, the turnover, the people who go home, you know, that then affects the amount of services and support that the refugees get. So yeah, that's a concept that we're working on right now, starting to maybe program some stretching, some yoga and meditation, some sharing circles, because all these things are really important to try and provide the infrastructure to allow people to accept self-care. Because it's even the same with money. If you try and say, hey, why don't, you know, can we give you a salary? They're like, I'm just going to pass it on to buy blankets or whatever for the refugees. It's very difficult for people that show up here to accept things. So yeah, those are some ideas on how we're going to try to incorporate that into these site plans. Just as important as, you know, laying out where the toilets are and all these things, I think it's also important to have space for volunteers that's not the office, that's not outside. I mean, all these people I've been working with, I didn't see them inside. You know, one of them doesn't have hair. One of them has red hair. I didn't know that, even though I've been working closely with these people for 2.5 weeks, because we've only been together outside in the freezing cold. And so getting a chance to sit down where we can write in our notebooks and discuss our ideas and not just be, you know, too cold that our hands couldn't even type on our phones. It's really important to have this space. So it's been set up with a fireplace and some carpet and some kind of wooden lounge chairs that we can sit around and talk. And yeah, that's one concept that we're working on to try and alleviate some of the burnout and the kind of lack of self-care that is inherent with response to these type of situations.
Well, and Mike, I gotta say, because I think I got a challenge for you that's gonna work for you. You have to model this to the people you're working with. It can't be the case that you take care of the other volunteers at the expense of yourself. You have to model to the other volunteers what it means to take breaks, what it means to go sit in the warmth, what it means to, like, you have to model it, man. Like, it's part of your leadership. So I don't want you out there making sure all the volunteers get taken care of and you not getting taken care of. And I know that that is hard for you. And we've talked about this. But Mike, you do so much. And we don't want you to get burnt out. And we don't want you to have health problems because you're not taking care of yourself. So I want to challenge you right here on a public platform to consider yourself in a role of modeling self-care as part of your service. What do you say?
I'll try.
Okay. That's all I can ask for. But I want to keep talking to you about this as this process is going. This feels like it's going to be a long crisis, and I know that you're going to be there, and I know that you're going to be showing up again and again, and I just want to make sure that you are taken care of, because I really care about you, and you do so much, and it's really important that you are safe and well as you do the work you're
doing.
Thanks,
Eamon. And I have, I took a day off last Sunday, and it was wonderful. I napped, I hung out at a pool, and I came back recharged. So I definitely know the value in sleeping and in kind of self-care. So like all of this, it's something to keep working on. And I appreciate the reminder. And I know I have burnt out before, and you were actually there for one of my burnouts events. You were the first friendly face or the first person I knew when that happened. And, you know, so you are in a position to be able to say something because you've witnessed it firsthand. So thanks for literally being there.
Mike, I've been a fan for years. I've been wanting to talk to you on this show for years. And I love that this is a public moment of sharing that self-care isn't a nice to have. It's just not, especially in these environments. And something that we've talked about is just trauma. You know, there's so much trauma coming out of these war-torn regions. These refugees are coming with so much pain. And then the volunteers and the people who are receiving them, they're experiencing trauma too. You're experiencing trauma too. And the more that a culture of awareness of this and some body work on the border, some stuff that can help move this through, is going to continue to create more health in these extremely unhealthy, fearful, dangerous, stressful environments. And I know you've been writing a toolkit. You've been writing it for years. And I know that self-care has got to be part of that toolkit, man. It has to be. And I will continue to check in with you and continue to talk about it because it's just so important. And I think that that actually, you know, Mike, I think this gives us our final moment of the podcast in this spirit of taking care of the caretakers. What can we do to help? There are people who've been listening to this show who know, obviously everyone knows what's going on in Ukraine, but to a certain degree, people are gaining awareness about what's happening in the border. What do you guys need there? How can we help? How can our listeners support?
Well, so the organization I came here with, Alight, their website is wearealight.org. And we're the only large organization that's shown up in the border, but we're not registered to work in Poland. So essentially, what we've been doing is just going around to all the different groups that are here and asking them what they need. And then returning with a truck full of whatever that is and just dropping it off. So Alight has shown up in a really wonderful way. And I believe very much in their methodology. That's why I work with them. Done everything. Today, we dropped off, you know, over 1,000 blankets to the Ukrainian side of the border because that's what they asked for. We've constructed beds when they're needed at the transition site. We've gotten medicine and all sorts of different things. And they're also, yeah, just supporting in any way they can because, you know, they've done this work. And like I said, there's no other large organization. The only group that I recognized when I got on site was World Central Kitchen. And they are a well-oiled machine. Our mutual friend, Sam Block, was kind of one of the first guys on the ground here helping set up their warehouses and distribution points and all these things. But yeah, so Alight has shown up in a really wonderful way. The other organization that is raising funds to support volunteers is to.org. They also have a crowdfunding campaign, which is largely going to send supplies deeper into Ukraine and then also to support Borders Without Borders and some of the volunteer organizations that are emerging. So there's a lot of very, you know, big need and different ways that people are supporting. The outpouring of support and financial contribution has been overwhelming. But those are two that I'm currently associated with that are deploying funds to the border in a way which is supporting the volunteers, which therefore support the refugees.
And so I know the fundraising is so important. Can people go? Can people go to Poland and show up and help? Is that valuable if people listening to this want to try to help in that way?
Yes, absolutely. This is such a massive scale of need, and it takes all types. As I said, we kind of were in emergency response, just trying to keep people alive and warm in the beginning. But now we're starting to see art emerge. Someone set up a giant canvas. There's some, you know, chalk drawings on the ground and hopscotch. JR, the French street artist, I was just with him yesterday,
He did a beautiful piece in Lviv, Ukraine, that was on the cover of Time magazine. So yes, we need artists and designers and architects and just people who care. And not just right now, but over the next 6 months to a year, who knows how long this is going to go on. Once it leaves the front of the news cycle, that's when you see donations drop off and volunteers drop off, but the need doesn't.
And Mike, how can we follow you and your work? I know that there's some things you touched on in this conversation around your philosophy and thinking about refugee environments. Do you write? Do you publish? Where can we follow you? Where can we continue to track the evolution of your thinking and as you support in these different environments around the world?
Right now, you can listen to Life is a Festival, and that's the kind of most thorough update I've given. I'm really focused on trying to do the work. And I also generally don't like to share too much until I feel like something's been accomplished. And this is such a massive challenge that it's, you know, I'm not sure when it's done. So anyway, I have a really mixed feeling about sharing. I do plan to eventually write more, like you were talking about, the kind of toolkit, how to prepare, how this, you know, learnings from this can be used in future crises. And I'll try to get on the gram more, Mike.Zuckerman. But generally, I'm, you know, head down trying to participate and be a part of it in the most helpful way I can, more so than share about it, for better or for worse. But that's why I'm glad that you were able to get a chance to chat this out, get some ideas out. I'm a bit tired and exhausted and a bit relieved to be taking a couple days off. I'll be sharing eventually, but I think for now I'm mostly focused on doing the work.
Well, Mike, you are welcome back on this show anytime. So if you want to share something you've been working on, or you just want to explore something and bang around some ideas, you always have a home here and a platform. And I know that there's lots of people who feel the same way about you, including Burning Man, who had you on their podcast, and, you know, IRL's showing up to support you. You know, you are very loved, and, you know, I really admire you. I really admire the work you do, and it's an honor to talk to you about it today, and I thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for being a friend. Thanks for being someone to talk to. And thanks for sharing this with your audience and our community. It's an honor.
Thank you for joining us for Life is a Festival. If you like the show, you can support it by sharing it with your friends, following it on Spotify, or reviewing it on iTunes. If you'd like to get more involved, you can join our Facebook group, Life is a Festival, where we talk about the show and you can suggest new guests. If you really liked the show and maybe want a little bit more, visit my digital tip jar at patreon.com/lifeisafestival.com. Whatever you do, I hope today's podcast helped you make your life just a little bit more like a festival, and I'll see you on the dance floor.